when I was in camp, I had a very close friend who used to say to me, Rena, sorry, she said, Rena, your dreams are like novels. My dreams are very complicated. I had dreams that I was running away from a Russian czar and hiding in the Kremlin and like all these kinds of, you know, things, right? I mean, which thank God I never actually had to handle or deal with. My dreams are something that's very, they're very vivid. I remember them very much when I wake up, and they're very complicated. And sometimes they're so real to the point that I called my aunt before we traveled to Israel last year, because I was afraid. I had had dreams of things, of my students sitting in particular seats that were not their usual seats, that when I came into school for finals, they were sitting in those seats. So they freaked me out a little bit. And I called my aunt. I said, what do I do with this? Because she's into Kabbalah meditation and all this stuff. So she gave me signs, like, to see how do I know if a dream is true or not, if it's something that could come true or something not, because I was afraid before I went to Israel. I was reading in the papers a lot about the bombings and stuff. Shouldn't happen anymore. Now we really have to daven, you know. Yeah. So yeah. I'm glad that they did it, but now we really have to daven. Mm-hmm. I was afraid that I was going to dream about bombings and burning buses and that then something would happen afterwards. I didn't, God forbid. Right, so she gave me signs to be able to tell if the dream was really true or not, which also freaked me out a little bit. Then we had a little joke going in our house, imagine Pashiach was a woman, you know, but whatever. So tonight I ask you about your dreams with that little introduction. What are your dreams like? Do you have a dream that you remember that you would like to share with us? Did you ever dream about something that actually came true?
My old dream come true.
Okay.
Hers are the fakest ones.
It's very real. Okay. Every time I see on the daytime, so like a deja vu, I saw somewhere.
Okay.
The first dream, we was in Israel. It was about 5 years ago. Me and three kids, we want to see my mother. They didn't see her for 6 years. They was very, you know, homesick.
Sure.
Yeah. What happened, we was in Hotel Kveria on 10th floor. And we have two rooms in hotel, one for kids and one for myself.
Right.
What happened, I went to go sleep. And when I was sleeping in the middle of night, my soul comes out from my body.
You're
and God just took me all the way up. And my body doesn't move, but I am feeling. And I am screaming, I said, God, please let me go. I didn't see Nachas from my kids yet. I have to see Nachas from my kids. Please let me go. I beg you. I didn't see nothing yet. And he just let me go. And soul comes out on my body and my blood, everything was like flushing in my body. It was so scary. I just
got
up. And I was moving my body. My body was moving.
Wow.
And I tell my kids right away, and I tell my mother. My mom said, don't worry, you're going to live long life. It's something good going to come out from that. It happened.
Wow.
It was so scary.
Oh my goodness.
You see, the people who doesn't believe God, when I tell story, they start believe. Because they come with their opinion and what happened with them. It's so good, you know. I was at the convention and talking about this dream. Because whatever Torah says, it happened with me.
Wow.
Soul comes out and in.
Oh my gosh.
I've read about people who've had a near-death experience.
Well, in a near-death situation.
And they feel they're just lying
in your bed.
Right.
Not necessarily.
Sure.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I mean, that's a tough act to follow.
I don't remember my dreams usually.
I remember one. And it wasn't scary. It was just, and it happened that, I know this sounds really crazy, but my husband and I had the same dream at the same time.
Oh, my.
Really? Yeah.
Did it come true?
Yeah, it did. It did. There was,
Was this something that you had discussed, the two of you?
No. We woke up, in fact, we were late waking up that morning. And when I woke up, I turned and I said, we're late. And he looked at me and we jumped up, we took off and went to work our own separate ways, never talked about it to each other. And when he came home, he says, I gotta tell you about this dream. I says, I gotta tell you about this dream. He says, no, let me tell you about mine first. And he started telling me dream, and I just got really, oh my God, you're telling me my dream, let me finish it, you know. And we had different perspectives in the dream. Yeah, it was pretty strange, but there were these, what I had called in the dream, elders. And they had taken us somewhere. We went this way. And we were following them, and we went into this place where there was like this water vessel. My background is Catholic, so it was a holy water vessel at the time. And we both stood there, and I saw people going and dipping their hands in it and crossing themselves. And I said, I'm not going to do this because I've been told to do this or because I have to do this. I'll do it because I want to do this. And my husband stood there, and he didn't take it, and he went off this way. And I started thinking, oh, gosh, you know, I don't want to do what he did, but yet I don't want to do it because I've been taught, you know. And then I ended up taking the water, and I went off to this side. And there was a bunch of what I called elders at the time. I have no idea why I called them that. They were just bigger and holier than now, than I was by far. And they were saying I was going to do something, and I kept saying, what am I going to do? And this one man stepped up, and he said, it's really hard being a mom, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it really is. And then they were preparing me for something, but I didn't know what it was that they were preparing me for. And then the next thing I know, I went up. My husband's here. I'm here. And I could see him over there, and he was with these dancers that had these olive branches, and they were floating in the air. And they were doing this, you know, kind of like dance that goes up and down, and he's watching that. And I could see him. And I went over from here to here, and I know this sounds really strange, but what I said it was, and I still believe it was God. I know that sounds weird, but it was God, and it was the strongest presence I have ever felt. It was the holiest presence. It was like nothing you could ever feel. And he was saying I was going to do something. But every time he'd tell me what I was going to do, it just went right past me. I couldn't catch on to what it was I was going to do. And then I somehow came out of there, and I was looking at my husband, and he was looking at me, and I said, are you sure you want to do this? He said, I've never been more sure of anything in my life. And the next thing I knew, I was right back to where, you know, the presence of God was. And I was begging him not to let me go. I said, please don't let me go. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I have to finish school, and I have to do this, and I have to do that. And I was fighting with him. And there was like a laughter, but it wasn't the kind of laughter that we have, but it was like a loving kind of, you know, I know, you know, but you're going to do this anyway, and you've got to go. And the next thing I know, I was facing my husband taking a tear off of his eye. And that was when we both woke up.
Oh, my goodness.
And he had the same dream?
Mm-hmm.
How far before?
He couldn't see me, though. He could see me from across the way, but he couldn't see me with these elders over here. He was into that dancing.
Was this dream before you converted?
Mm-hmm. Many years before.
And what about your husband?
He
I don't want to get...
No, it's okay. He converted, but 5 weeks later he left.
You mean he became Christian again?
No, he never was really Christian. He was nothing. He was searching for something. He was really searching.
And what did he convert from?
Nothing. He didn't have any religion.
Well, he was born something.
No, he didn't have anything. They didn't practice anything. His grandfather, way back, was a Methodist minister.
What about his...
His father didn't do anything. So, and then a lot of things happened. And in the dream, the elders had asked me, too, what are you going to name him? And I thought, we can't have any kids, you know. And I kept going, wait a minute, we can't have any kids. So what's the deal here? We can't have kids. But then I gave him a name, and I do have that person. And he's the only one.
Wow.
strange.
So I don't know.
Hmm. Now, not all dreams that we remember necessarily as deep and emotionally, spiritually moving as these dreams are that we've spoken about. We might remember dreams that have no seeming significance whatsoever.
I'm a very plain person. I don't dream anything.
Not a dream at all.
I remember as a child
having recurring dreams of Cookie Monster showing up over the back of our grill, you know, but it happened often, you know. Did that mean anything?
Well,
no.
When I was young, I used to dream that I could fly.
I also did.
Instead of swimming water, I'm swimming in water.
Get up and fly.
No, I could just fly around. Yeah. Of course, I had that too.
I think it's a sign
of a creative mind or something.
I had a dream.
You mean I'm flighty?
No, God forbid.
I had a dream. My aunt, Shalom, before she passed away, when she was very sick, and I had a dream like she was in the hospital. So I woke up, I'm like, Mom, something might be wrong with Auntie. She might be in the hospital. So Mom calls and they said, yeah, she's in the hospital. She's in critical condition.
So some of us, I think that there's certain dreams do have an element of prophecy in them.
Well, I can understand Sawyer's dream because obviously you were concerned about your aunt.
Sure.
So you put her in the hospital so she'd get better.
Sure.
Could you see, even Yotzak, whoever passed away, from our family, everybody who ever have Yotzak, I see in my dream, in this month they are Yotzak memory. Like my aunt, she passed away in January, and she came to my dream. And she let me know it's her Yotzak. And her little boy was sick. And I called right away when I wake up, and he was sick in the hospital. And she asked me to go. Because she knows when I with them, everything's fine.
But many times, even if we wake up and remember the dream, you know, most of the time we really don't remember our dreams. I think we dream thousands of dreams every night. And the dreams to us, which feel like they last for hours, can only last for minutes or seconds even. But many times even we remember dreams that have absolutely no meaning whatsoever, totally bizarre, you know, like the dream that I, like the dream that I had running away from the Russian Tsar, you know, how long ago were the Russian Tsars alive, and did I ever have anything to do with them, you know, I don't know, my aunt maybe would argue that in a past life I had that similar experience, but many of us will say that we often have dreams that really mean absolutely nothing, and it's sometimes very often hard to discern and to determine what's really a prophecy dream. And what's really not a prophecy dream? So I want to start with dreams, as you probably guessed this evening, with the dreams of Yosef.
The dreams that you might have dreamt was maybe something that you had read about in the past.
That I had read about or I was thinking about. It could be, definitely. So I want to look at
Deborah's dream seems really strange.
Well, I'm not a dream analyst.
Never told anybody.
I could give you my aunt's number if you want to talk to her.
Both of you
meant
the same thing.
I know.
If you'll open up your Chumashim, please, to page 200 and 201 in the beginning of Perek Lamed Zayin and Parshat Vayeshev, where we have possibly one of the most famous dreams, two of the most famous dreams in the Torah. We start with Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Ve'achalom Yosef Chalom. Yosef dreamt a dream. You'll see, we'll connect it, don't worry, to women in Tanakh. Ve'achalom Yosef Chalom, he dreamt a dream, Vayaged Le'achav, and he did tell his brothers, Ve'yosifu Otsino Oto. And they continued to hate him even more than they had before. Ve'yomer Aleim, he said to them, Shimu Naha Chalom Adasher Chalamti, listen to this dream I dreamt. You have to hear my dream. We are gathering sheaves in the field. My sheaves, my packet of wheat stood up. And your sheaves all surrounded mine. And they all bowed down to my stack of wheat. His brother said to him, you're going to be our leader now? Would you then reign over us? Would you dominate us? They continued to hate him, if possible, even more than they hated him before. Echalom od chalom acher. He dreamt another dream. And yes, he was foolish enough to, Vayisap Heroto Leachav, to once again inform his brothers of his dream. Vayomer, he says, Hine chalanti chalom od, I dreamt another dream. Vine Hashemesh vayareach. The sun and the moon and 11 stars were all bowing down to me. And he told his father, his brothers, and his father said to him, Ma chalom hazeh shechalamta, avon avon. You know, like, what are you thinking of these silly, stupid things? Your mother's dead already, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It's not going to come true. It's not a true. Well, why are you dreaming it? Why are you even going around telling people about it? So the question is, yeah, just over here.
Thank you.
Why do the brothers really hate Yosef?
Thank you.
What was really the issue? What was it about the dream that illustrates to us in the strongest of ways what the feud was all about?
Well, he's telling them that he's going to be dominating them.
Okay.
I think
so. So therefore you're saying that it was jealousy?
Yeah. Okay. I would say so.
Okay. They said, who are you? You should go to be over us.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes.
I think it goes back to their mothers.
Okay.
And that they're jealous because they know that Rachel was number one wife.
Okay.
And they were jealous of him because he was the son of the favored wife.
That may be so, but why did he have to stir up the extra trouble?
Because he wasn't smart enough to.
I think it's because he was the son of his father's old age, and his father learned with him more, and while the other brothers had to be in the field and doing whatever they were supposed to do, and he was probably also spoiled. He was very spoiled by his father and his mother, so he felt like, since I'm all, you know, haughty, and so he also wanted to mention the dream probably because maybe from that dream something will come about. And he told his father about it.
And he also told his brothers about it.
Right.
Right. So that's the question of what is going on here. We're telling the brothers about it. So we have some jealousy. We have that it's going back to the mother, that the mother is the favorite one. We have that he's the favored one, spoiled by both of his parents. All definitely possible. But I want to suggest to you the next step that builds really on all of your ideas. That the struggle, I think, that's inherent here is the struggle between Rachel and Leah. Not on who's going to be the favorite wife, but who's going to be the leader of the Jewish people. Notice that they don't hate Binyamin. Binyamin being the youngest, truly the youngest son, and truly the son of his father's old age, doesn't figure into this equation at all. It's Yosef as the oldest of his mother's children, versus, if we look further, let's look at the story of the selling of Yosef. Turn the page. They're going and they're shepherding in the field. Verse 18. They're going there in the field, far away from their father's home. Yosef comes and chases, looking for them. Before he even gets to him, they're already planning to kill him. And one says to the other, look, the dreamer's coming now. Let's kill him, throw him in one of the pits, and we'll say that a wild beast ate him, and we'll see what happens of his dreams. Who's going to really be the one in charge of it? And what does Reuven say? Vayishma Reuven. Reuven, the oldest of Leah's children, saves him from their hands and says, well, let's not kill him. Don't throw him into the pit. Throw him into this pit, but don't touch him. And then he sort of turns away, which is unsure what his purpose, what does he think would happen if he turned away. And so Yosef came, they took off the coat, they threw him in the pit, and they sat down and had this great big feast. And then this group of merchants come along, and who's the one who suggests, let's sell him to the merchants?
Reuben.
Yehuda. And Reuben comes back to the store, and he's surprised, shocked, that
what happened
to Yosef. So we have the principal players, and that's what they do, and they return, he's not there, he tears his clothes, he said, where is he? And they say, oh, we sold him, and they trick their father and all this kind of stuff. But the major players in the story are Reuven and Yehuda. Reuven is the oldest of Leah's children, and Yehuda, who we know now, in hindsight, who comes from Yehuda?
We do.
The kings. The kings of the Jewish people come from Yehuda. So we have the oldest of Leah's children and the king,
versus the oldest of Rachel's children, and the struggle of who is going to dominate over all of the Jewish people. Now, let's develop this this sibling rivalry a little bit further. In the beginning of this chapter, chapter 37, right when we're introduced to the whole story and the relationship between Yosef and his brothers, on page 198, Vayeshev Yaakov, Beres Megurei Aviv, Beres Kanaan, Yaakov is living in the land where his fathers lived in Canaan. Elah told her Yaakov, these are his histories. Yosef ben Shavar Shana, Yosef was 17 years old, he shepherded his brothers with the sheep, Behu Na'ar, at Bnei Dolha, at Bnei Zopar, Meshe Aviv, and he was a youth, Bnei, the children of Bilha and the children of Zilpah, the wives of his father. Very strange syntax going on in that sentence. Now Rashi asked the question, let me hand out the sources to you.
Instead of
So this is what the commentary struggled to try to understand because it doesn't make sense. The word et doesn't have a comparable translation in English. Right. It's an article that doesn't seem to belong here. Also, ro'eh et echav bachon also doesn't belong there.
No.
It should be ro'eh im echav bachon. Right. So that's the question. That's one of the questions that they try to understand what it means. And Rashi says that in this case, et with b'nei Bilha, b'nei Zilpa truly means in. Source number one, et b'nei Bilha, klomar to say, v'ragil eitzel b'nei Bilha l'fishayu achav m'vazinotam v'hu mekarvan. The downtrodden stick together. How did the brothers treat the children of the maids of Bilha and Zilpa? How did they treat them?
Like they were the maids. Kids.
Yes, they scorned them. They pushed them away. They had absolutely zero respect for them. Who associated with them?
Yosef.
Why? Not out of the goodness of his heart necessarily, but because possibly he too was scorned and pushed to the side by his brothers. Part jealousy because he's Rachel's son, and partly because they sort of discounted him. They said, we're going to be in charge of the Jewish people. You want to say something, Sophie?
Yeah, I think probably with them, he feels a little elevated.
Yes.
With the others, he's down. With them, he's, you know.
Right, he's the top banana. And we do have a concept of hierarchy among the Sephardim. Among the 12 tribes, there is a hierarchy of higher and lower. For example, we just read in this last week's parsha, if you turn to page 520, where Hashem appoints the two leaders of the building of the Mishkan, Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'Matei Yehuda. This is actually mentioned in our speech on Shabbat. I'm taking it from him. Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, from the tribe of Yehuda, and a little bit further down the page in Pasuk Lamed Dalet, and Ahaliyav ben Achishamach l'Matei Dan. It's interesting to note that when we're given someone's lineage, it stops at a certain point. And it goes as further back also. Why does it go as far back as the tribes for us to understand which tribes they're from? That it's Bezalel who's from Shevet Yehuda together with Ahaliyah ben Achishamach from the tribe of Dan. Rashi suggests in source number two, why do we need to know that Ahaliyah is from Shevet Dan, from the tribe of Dan? Shevet Dan mehayirudim shabashvatim, from the lowest of the tribes. Why? Me b'nei hashvachot. He was one of the maidservant's children. But how come the two of them both were supposed to work hand in hand? To build the Mishkan. Bezalel is from the highest of the Shvatim, from Yehuda, from the kingship. Yehuda, Gor Aryeh Yehuda. Yehuda comes in like a roaring lion. He is the top. He is the best of the Shvatim. And he is put together to work with Ahaliyav, who's from the worst of the Shvatim. Shevet Dan walked at the end. When they walked in their line in the Midbar, Shevet Dan was at the end. All the stragglers, all the Nebuchadnezzars, anyone, they would go pick up all the things people dropped behind. That's what Shevet Dan did. Why were they put together? Finishes Rashi so that everybody will understand that Hashem makes no distinction. Just because you're a higher or better Shevet or more princely, a more royal Shevet than the other one, you're all together and my age together. However, still, of course, there has to be a hierarchy because there has to be a leader.
There has to be a division of labor. Everyone has different qualities. Everyone gets different jobs. We see this that even Yaakov views his children, which is probably where his children picked it up from, as different levels. Turn to his meeting with Esav. I was going to put all of the sources on here so we didn't have to flip around our chumashim so much, but I think it's easier if we just have two pages instead of five to look through.
Right.
So that's why we're flipping so much. Page 176. Yaakov returns to the land of Israel after having been in Laban's house for, we figured it out, 14, 6, what do we say, 20, 21 years. And he comes and he opens his eyes, he lifts up his eyes, paraglam and gimel in the middle of the page, Vayisai Yaakov Einav, he lifts up his eyes and he sees Esav is coming with 400 men. That's 613 Torah Avenue, smelling Esav is coming with 400 men, Yaakov davens to Hashem. So Esav is coming with 400 men, and immediately Vayachat, Pesach's coming up, Vayachat et ha-yeladim al-leyah v'al-rachil v'al-shtei ha-shvachot, he divides up the children by mother, to Leah, to Rachel, and the two maids. Vayashem et ha-shvachot v'yaldehen rishonah, he puts the maids and their children first, v'et Leah v'yaladah ha-acharonim, and Leah after them, v'et Rachel v'et Yosef ha-acharonim, all the way at the end we have Rachel and Yosef. And here we have that famous Rashi I brought you in source number 3. What does this order tell us? That the children of Shvachot, and then the children of Leah, and then the children of Rachel. Says Rashi, this teaches us, Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. The last is the most favorite. Because even Yaakov saw a hierarchy among the Shvatim. And this is something that his children clearly picked up on. Okay. Let's take this hierarchy for a moment to the next step. We've mentioned before that Rachel is his favorite wife. But Rachel has a very low, small amount of children. We also asked the question about 5 weeks ago, if you remember. I said that I was determined to understand why is it that when we list the Imahot, we list them as Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, if it's not an age order. And I promised you I would find an answer. And I did, and I saved it for now, because it fits in so well with our discussion here on the hierarchy. And I brought it to you in source number 5. This is a midrash from Bereishit Rabbah, which we've been actually, along the course of this class, we've been studying it quite a bit, this section from Bereishit Rabbah. I've been giving you little snippets of it. He addresses the question, the midrash addresses the issue that v'rachil akara, that Rachel was a barren woman, and he just a little play on words. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak is a play on words. Rachel haita ikaro shalvayet. She was the mainstay of the house. She was the most important. She was the focus of the house. He uses the same shorish, as the same root from the word barren in Hebrew, akara, and he says she was the ikar, the main point of the house. Kamasha ne'amar, as the Torah says, v'rachel akara. What does it mean, Rachel Akara? Ikara Rachel, that Rachel was the most important. Amar Rabbi Abba. Okay, Rachel Ikara. Okay, we're going to skip a little bit. Tani Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, the end of the third line. Lefi Shekol HaDvarim, why is she considered the Ikara? Why is she the focus? Shekol HaDvarim Tulin B'Rachel. Because everything is hinged on Rachel. Everything depends upon her. Lefichach nikra'u Yisrael al shema. The Jewish people are called by her name. So here we have to flip all the way to the end of your book. So that's Torah, the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And we'll be coming back to this a little bit later on. I'm on page 1237. The Haftarah for the second day of Rosh Hashanah comes from Yirmiyahu, which if any of you have glanced at any part of Yirmiyahu, you will know that Yirmiyahu, by and large, is an unbelievably, overwhelmingly depressing piece of literature. However, this is one of the very few positive topics, and in here is one of the most moving sections of the Navi. We start with Pasuk Yadalid, verse 14. Ko Amar Hashem, God says as follows. Ko b'ramah nishma, I hear a sound coming from Ramah, from on high. Nehi b'chit hamurim. I hear this wailing sound. It's like when I teach this to my students, I describe it like a movie. You just see the landscape. And you hear a sound, but you can't identify what it is. And then the sound becomes clearer and clearer, and you hear that it's a crying. And then the Pasuk explains to us who is crying. Rachel mevaka al baneha. Rachel is crying for her children. She refuses to be comforted over her children, ki einenu, because they are no longer there. Where is she crying? Where are her children? Why is she crying at this point? Anybody familiar with the history at all? At this point, Yirmiyahu was the Navi of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the first temple in Jerusalem. So the Jewish people are already exiled at this point, and when they go into exile, they walk past Kever Rachel. They walk past her tomb. And the Navi is describing us. She's like sitting there, so to speak. And she sees her children, Banaha, her children, the Jewish people are being called Rachel's children. How many of them are Rachel's children? Especially, think, okay, get this one, okay? The first temple was destroyed and the Jewish people sent into exile. By that time, the 10 tribes had already been exiled almost 200 years before. So the only tribe that's really exiting now past her tomb are Yehudah and those Leviim who lived in Yehudah, Leah's children. But the Navi's calling them Rachel's children because of Rachel, they came about. She was the catalyst. She was the one who got things rolling, who got things moving. We spoke about the midrash of her giving the signs. It's written on this pasuk. Why are they called her children? Why is she crying? And why does her cry, of all the other cries, make God, in the next sentence, Kol Amar Hashem, God says, Min'i kolech mibechi. Stop your voice from crying. Be'inayach miziman. Stop your eyes from tearing. There is a reward to your effort, says God. The Shavu me'erato yeben, they will come back from the land of the enemy. Who enables them to come back to the land of Israel?
Rachel.
Only Rachel. And who comes back initially, you should know. 30,000 members of the tribe of Yehudah and 13,000 of everybody else. Because everybody else by this point in history is pretty much assimilated and lost. We can't even identify him, even at this point in history. Forget now. Of course now we can't even identify them. They're called the 10 lost tribes. People along the way have laid claim to being part of those tribes, but, you know. So Rachel seems to be, from this source particularly, that she's the leader of everyone, that she was the catalyst. But we have this question that we don't really understand, because how can she be called the leader if the actual children are Leah's children that we're talking about? And it continues even calling her children again a little bit further on. In the last verse of that section, Haben Yahir Li Ephraim, my dear son Ephraim. God is talking about the Jewish people and he calls them Ephraim. Ephraim was Yosef's child. He's calling again. He's calling the Jewish people after Rachel's family. So Rachel seems to have been the focus. So what was it about Rachel? In verse number 6, we're going to go back to Rachel and Leah, and then we'll finish up with Rachel. Sorry, not verse number 6. Source number 6. Source number 6 is an interesting quote from the book of Ruth. We're for sure going to get to talking about Ruth. I think this we'll all do next time. We'll just do women in the rest of Tanakh, because we have to do Ruth around Shavuot's time. I mean, that's just... We could do the whole thing on Ruth, even. I mean, we could do a week, a chapter. We could do the last 4 weeks. On, oh, gosh, we're going to have so much fun. Okay, I think we're going to do... I think we're going to go... Maybe time... I don't know what we're going to do, but we have to do Ruth at Shavuot's time. It just makes sense. Okay, so I'll work it out. Not after Pesach, I'll think about it. You know, it'll still be women in Tanakh, but okay. So Ruth goes through this whole thing just to give you a quick summary. Ruth is a Moabite woman. not a Jewish woman, who marries into a Jewish family, who dies. She's left with her mother-in-law. They come back to Israel, and her mother-in-law tells her, you need to take initiative, and you need to chase after this really old guy who owns a really big field, because he's our closest relative, and you have to marry him. And he's a really good guy to marry. So Ruth, being a somewhat young woman as opposed to the really old Boaz, dresses herself up nicely and appears in the granary in the middle of the night and looks at him and says, like, she really takes a very strong stance on this and says to him, you have to marry me. Bottom line, you have to marry me. And he looks at her and is like, okay. And she stays overnight and she wakes up in the morning. He says to hurry home before everybody sees. We can discuss what happened actually that night. I mean, this is Ruth and Boaz and pretty big tzaddikim. And he marries her in front of the whole town. First, this other relative who was really closer had to say, no, I don't want to marry her. Don't worry. I have a whole other family, wife and children. I don't really need her. And Boaz says, great, I'll marry her. And the whole town, including the elders, gives her a bracha, which I brought to you in source number 6. Vayomru kol ha'am asher bashar, nazakeinim, eidim. All the people in the gate and the older people said, eidim, we're witnesses. Yitain Hashem et ha'isha ha'ba'al beitacha. May God give this woman who is coming into your home, make her like Rachel uchaleya. Like Rachel and Leya, asher banush dehem et beit Yisrael. That the two of them built together, built the house of Israel. And she should do glory in Ephrat and perpetuate your name in Beit Lechem. Something that's interesting to note, Beit Lechem is actually where Rachel was buried, and Ephratah is also near there, in that household. But then they also give her the second bracha, that your house should be like the house of Peretz, who was born through Tamar and Yehuda, who was Leah's son. So, okay. But the question that we have, why are they giving her the bracha she should be like Rachel and Leah? And those of you who are familiar with the Hebrew language and Hebrew grammar will notice that what does it say about Rachel and Leah? You should be like Rachel and Leah, asher banush dehem et bnei Yisrael. What should it have said? Asher banu stehen. Two of them, plural feminine. It's written plural masculine. What the heck is going on? Turn the page. Source number 7. Source number 7 is the commentary on the Chidah. I did not buy the Chidah. I did not know who the Chidah was. And before, I can never bring anybody in. I have to always say who he is. I can't just bring him in because, I mean, what's the point of learning him in a vacuum? The Chidah, says the OU, was one of the most fascinating and multifaceted figures in Jewish history. It's a pretty tall order. His name is Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai. Chaim Yosef David Azulai. He lived from 1724 to 1806, and he was associated with the Rosh Hashanah Kabbalists as Rabbi Shalom Sharabi, and studied under Reb Chaim Ibn Attar, who wrote the Or HaChaim, if you're familiar with that. In 1753, he traveled to Europe and is an emissary of the communities from Eretz Israel. So he was really focused in Eretz Israel. That was his location. His wife died when he was... His wife died when he was in Tunis, and he was forced to conceal her death for fear that the community would force him to remarry. Mourning in solitude, he wrote that she was, quote, perhaps unique in the generation, in wisdom, honor, powerful and awesome intellect, grace, beauty, great modesty, and extraordinary cleanliness. Very interesting. So he is interesting because, you know, I truly believe that people's, particularly Mefarshim, the commentators, that their personal life experiences probably influence their appearance somewhat. Although you can't just do it on a one-time thing, you have to do it across the board. But he says something very interesting. Why does it say that Shar Amru Shtehem Bechinah Hazachar V'lo Shtehem? Why does it say Shtehem in masculine and not in feminine? L'fi Shehi Rut Tav'at B'fiha K'Rachel U'Chileah Shetav'u B'fiha. That Rut, like Leah and Rachel, acted in a masculine way. How did they act in a masculine way? Leah, when she said, Eli Tavo, in your mind tonight, come to me. Remember after the Judaim. Rachel, when she said, give me kids. V'asuk zachar ha-tovea b'shid. L'fi she-berchu ha-shutiyek Rachel chorela, et shmah mezale b'beit lechem derech ha-fata, v'aza amru v'asei chayel b'fata. And it continues on. Just like Rachel and Leah took matters into their own hands and did something that is not normally the feminine way to act, they took charge and took the initiative in the area of having children. This is something that usually the men are the ones that take the initiative in this. And they both said, Leah said, you're mine tonight. Rachel said, give me kids. And Ruth herself went to Boaz and said, it's time for us to get married. We need to do this. So therefore, the three of them were grouped together because they did, they acted the way that they needed to act in times of need.
They took the initiative.
They took the initiative. Now, this goes back to my whole general theory. I think, and I've been discussing this with my husband, he said it was interesting, that that Rachel and Leah, we've spoken about Rachel last week, we spoke about her, the concept of the means justifying the ends for Rachel, that she'll do whatever it takes to ensure that she is the leader of the Jewish people, so that her motives are positive, but she'll do whatever it possibly takes to get to her goal. And I think that both of them, I mean, Maya also did that with giving Zilpah to her husband also. You know, she'll do whatever needs to be done. I think that they both, although Rachel learned it more than Maya, because they both, they both learned it from Laban, their father, who would do whatever needed to be done in order to accomplish his goal, such as switching Rachel and Maya, such as earlier taking Rivka out of the house with Briut. You know, like Laban was a go-getter guy, and no matter what, and Rachel and Maya learned it, and as we suggested, which I think this is very true, oh my gosh, I hope you're not getting sick. Are you sick already?
Yeah, I go.
Oh no.
Today happened.
I think maybe that Rachel learned, my husband suggested maybe Rachel learned it more stronger than Leah did, because we saw many opportunities, many instances in which Rachel did this, because Rachel, if you remember, was the shepherdess. Leah wasn't the working girl. She wasn't the one who would necessarily spend time with her father going over the books and, you know, of the family business. So that was an interesting point that he made about that. And I just had a fleeting thought that just ran in and out of my mind as I was saying that. Why did Rachel learn it more than Leah? I don't remember what it was. It was a good one. I'm sure it'll come back. Okay. So how does this translate over? This struggle, we spoke already last week about the struggle between Rachel and Leah, who was going to be the head of, that was the thought that went through my head, was Dina. If you're familiar with the story of Dina, that when Dina goes out to Shechem and Hamor sees her and takes her, that she's first introduced at the beginning of the parak. If you look at it, it's parak lamed chet, I think. We're back in our bereshit in the 200s, the early 200s. No, not lamed chet. It's before then. It's at the end at where are we? It's before. Here it is. It's Lamed Dalet, page 180. The first on page 180, you'll see in the first pasuk of Parak Lamed Dalet. One of the things that's very interesting to note as you go through the whole story of Parak Lamed Dalet, the whole story of Dina, is Dina is referred to by different references. During the course of the parish, she's sometimes referred to as Yaakov's daughter, as Shimon and Levi's sister. And at this point in the beginning, she's referred to as Bat Leah. Bat Tetzei Dina Bat Leah, that Dina, the daughter of Leah, went out. And Rashi comments on this point. But why is she referred to here particularly as Leah's daughter? Because just like Leah was an outgoer, Dina was also an outgoer. What's the proof that Leah was an outgoer? How did she go out?
She met her husband
coming in from the field, and she said, tonight you're mine. So something that's interesting that it seems to have, you know, could be that Dina was going then to look for a husband at this point. She said, it's time for me to take matters into my own hand. My father's hiding me in boxes here so that Esau doesn't grab me. You know, it's an interesting thought that this idea of Rachel and Leah's struggle is clearly evident in the struggle between their children as well. And it doesn't just go through there. I showed you with the selling of Yosef that it's Reuven and Yehuda on one side versus Yosef on the other side. I want to point out to you also that if any of you are familiar with the beginning of Malachim, after Shlomo dies, King Shlomo, well, actually, who's the first king of the Jewish people? Is not even King David. The first king of the Jewish people is Shaul, who was from the tribe of? Yeah.
Benjamin?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Shaul was from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin being Rachel's child. The first king was from Rachel. And then after him, then the dynasty began with David. But after Shlomo, David's son, died, his son Rechavam gets up and he makes this whole big speech to the people. He's really young. And he says to his advisors, what should I do? Should I raise taxes or lower taxes? If I raise taxes, they'll hate me now, but they'll respect me. If I lower taxes, they'll like me now, but they may not do anything I say. And his advisor said to him, lower taxes. His friend said to him, his advisors who had been with his father, his friend said to him, raise taxes. He gets up, he gives this whole big speech. He says, my father hit you with one whip, I'm going to hit you with 10 whips, I'm going to be worse than my father. He gives this whole terrible speech, and people says, who the heck needs you? And only Yehudah stays with him, the tribe of Yehudah stays with him, and Binyamin, because their things are right next to each other, some of Binyamin, and the rest of them all follow this other king. This is the split of the kingdom between the kingdom of Judah, Malchut Yehudah, Malchut Israel, the kingdom of Israel, and the kingdom of Israel is led by the first king, which is Yerovam ben Nevat, who is not from that Yehudah family. I'm sort of making that up. He's from Ephrath. It says, you know what I'm saying to you. I thought I didn't have a chance to look at the context, but it really has potential. Okay.
Sort of making it up.
Okay, let's continue. But the struggle really exists.
It's not about myself, out there. What's
no, it's not about myself, because I'll tell you why, because it says Yerovam ben Nevat Ephrata. And then it says something else, then it says the town he was from, which means that Ephrat was not the town he was from. So I'm assuming that Ephrat could mean that he was from Shevet Ephraim, but I could be totally making that up. So if anyone was listening to that on the tape, that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. I didn't get a chance to do that. I'm thinking, because I think it should work. It would work if it would work, it would be really cool. And anyway, but it probably won't work. Okay. But the struggle is ultimately played out. The struggle, not only the struggle, but ultimately, it's not the struggle, but what I presented to you, what was presented at least in source number six, source number five, in Zechariah, of Rachel being the one who facilitated everything and who enabled everything to happen, is that the struggle between the Rachel and Leah's children of ruling the Jewish people is not a struggle where it's one over the other. The ends, and we spoke about this for the last few weeks also, Rachel and Leah together are necessary for leading the Jewish people, for creating the leaders of the Jewish people. That Rachel's children seem to be the catalyst. We have Shaul from Binyamin as the first king to sort of pave the way so that the Yehudah dynasty can begin. And this same pattern is played out in the times of Mashiach. You may or may not be familiar with this concept, but in the time of Mashiach, there will be two Mashiachs, a Mashiach ben Yosef and a Mashiach ben David. That's how they're referred to. Mashiach from Rachel's family and a Mashiach from Leah's family. But they are not going to coexist. Says the Navi explains to us that Mashiach ben Yosef will come first and the Mashiach ben David will come afterwards. And I want to point out to you in source number 8 what happens to Mashiach to Mashiach ben Yosef. Tanu Rabbanan, source number 8 is the Gemara in Sukkah. Tanu Rabbanan, Mashiach ben David, she'atid lihigalot b'mher v'yameinu. Mashiach, the son of the Davidic Mashiach, then in the future will be revealed, in the future will redeem us quickly in our days. It should happen. Omer lo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says to him, sha'al mimeni devar v'etein lecha. Ask me whatever you want and I'll give you. Shneimar, Sapral Chok, the Gomer, Ani Hayom Yilaretich, I gave birth to you. Ask me whatever you want, I'll give you. The Kevan Shara'ah, I'm in the middle of line 4 or 5. Now here's the order of events. Mashiach ben Yosef gets killed, and then Mashiach ben David is the one who comes into power. When he sees Mashiach ben Yosef killed, what does he say? Omer lefanav, he says to God, Ribono shel olam, God, eini mevakesh mimcha el chayim. All I want is to live. Omer lo chayim ad shelo amarta kvar hitnabe alecha David. Avicha, Chaim, I already promised David that you're going to have. Don't worry, you will have it. You will have life.
Why does
and that's not
have
an issue.
A yod in it?
Why does what?
Ani.
Well, Amy, I do not. Amy mevakesh mimcha el
Chaim.
I do not request anything other than life. In other words, I only request
what
from you life.
What is that you had made, huh?
Yeah.
Ani or Amy.
Yeah. Now there's I attach this idea, this similar kind of midrash shows up later on to understand the process of the Mashiach, of the different Mashiachs that come, shows up in connection to when Yaakov is coming back from Laban's house. He sends messengers to Esav with gifts to greet Esav. And he says, tell Esav that I lived in Laban Garti with Laban. I have lived in Ifer Arata, and I was delayed there until now. So the Midrash Seichel told is another edition of a different kind of Midrash, says, what is he saying? Amar Yaakov says, Bebeit Lavan Hishlamti Taryag Mitzvot, in Lavan's house I kept the 613 Mitzvot. I had already kept all of them. Like in Lavan's house, I got to keep all 613, because until then I kept everything except for the Mitzvot procreating. And in Lavan's house I was able to do that. Bebeit Lavan Hishlamti, I finished, and Amar Ve'avod Yisrael B'Yishar V'Yishar Shamar. As the Navi tells us that he worked there and he got a woman. Until Yosef was born, Yosef, the antithesis of Esav, as it says, the house of Yaakov is a fire, Ubeit Yosef lahava, and the house of Yosef is a flame, Ubeit Esav lakash, and Beit Esav then will become like straw. I want you to look, this pasuk actually shows up in the beginning, in the Haftorah for Parshat Vayishlach. The Haftorah for Parshat Vayishlach is the entire book of Sefer Obadiah, which is one parak, page 1142 actually. That's the entire book of Obadiah?
I think pretty much, yeah.
The house of Jacob will be a fire, verse 18. The house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esav like straw. They will kindle among them and consume them, and there will be no survivor of the house of Esav, for Hashem has spoken. On that verse, Radak comments in source number 9, V'haya kamoa esha chlakash, kini achlum v'yachlu. Just like the fire consumes the straw, they will also consume them, and they will be finished. Beit Yaakov and Beit Yosef are synonymous. Beit Yaakov nikra Beit Yosef. Beit Yaakov is called Beit Yosef miyom shenechleku hamalchut, from the time that the kingdom was divided. Beit Yaakov, the house of Yaakov, is called the house of Yosef. Aval la'atid tashuv achat, but in the future they will turn to one. Razal dashu, Chazal explained, ki zecher Yosef lefi she'en zaro shel Esav nofel ela biyad Yosef o biyad zaro shel Yosef, that the only one who can ever destroy Esav is Yosef. That Yosef, the Mashiach ben Yosef, is the one who completely destroys. Look in source number 11. I don't know if I have the whole thing. I think I... Okay. A man is going to come. There's a little bit that comes before source number 11, which is also a midrash. A man is going to come up, and he's going to say he's Mashiach. He is Mashiach ben Yosef. The people come, will arise, not the Jewish people, but the other nations will arise, and they will kill him. God will appear from heavens. A loud noise and earthquake will come out of Zion and from the holy place. And a loud sound will be heard. All the Jewish people will find favor in the eyes of God.
In place of the destroyed Jerusalem, the rebuilt Jerusalem will descend from heaven. And a sprig from the root of, from the trunk of the family of Yishai, who are Mashiach ben David, your heir, the Mashiach from David will appear. Kakatu b'sefer v'ruach svatav yamit rasha, that with the wind of his mouth he will kill all the enemies. Mashiach ben Yosef yumat, b'neis Mashiach ben David yitnoseis. That Mashiach ben Yosef will be killed, he'll die, and Mashiach ben David then will wave his flag afterwards. Hu yamit et kol chel tzava Gog u'Magog, he will then kill. Mashiach ben Yosef will die in the war of Gog u'Magog, says this Midrash, the apocalypse. Mashiach ben Yosef will die in that war, and Mashiach ben David will then be able to come in and kill all the soldiers from that war. Eliyahu will come and he will announce, Yibaser Tov Yisrael, he will announce good to the Jewish people, L'chayim, L'amitim, to the alive and the dead. Yashuv Yivneh Mikdash Hashem, he will come and rebuild the Mikdash Hashem, and they'll all ride into Yerushalayim, and they'll blow on the shofar. But what's the bottom line? Rachel's child, Mashiach ben Yosef, yes, he has to die. But in order for Mashiach ben David to happen, Mashiach ben Yosef has to happen first. Mashiach ben David will not come about. Leah's children will not rule over the Jewish people until Rachel's children take care of it first. Yehuda was only able to be the king of the Jewish people after Yosef went down to Mitzrayim, and he enabled the Jewish people's time in Mitzrayim. And he took care of that, and he started that whole process going. Now, Rachel's children don't always start an easy process, but they're an integral part of the process, and the rest of the process cannot happen without her children being involved before the first step, just like she was when she gave over the signs to her sister Leah. And Rachel is the one, remember we mentioned it at the beginning, that we read in the Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah, Rachel is the one that God says to her, V'shavu banim nigvulam, that your children then will return from the enemy's lands into Eretz Israel. Rachel is the one who gathers them back. She is the uniter. She is the she has this particular kind of quality of uniting. She is the one who is in Beit Lechem, who is on the borders of Eretz Israel, who sees them out and escorts them back in. She's the one. Rav Yadid, who I mentioned to him a few times before in this class, explains that Rachel is the one that the all of them together, when Rachel gathers them back all together, there will be Echad, the Aleph from Yaakov Avinu, the Chet, the eight children that are born between Leah and Rachel themselves, and the Dalet, the four children born from the Shvachot, from the maidservants. All them together will be the Echad, and it's all facilitated because of the qualities that the Maharal explained. He was an 18th century, 17th century scholar in Prague. Maharal explains that she is the one who has this particular quality of being able to bring everyone together to enable so that then Mashiach ben Yosef will come, and then Mashiach ben David. So we will end on that note, and we should all increase our tefillot as our prayers that to hurry the bringing of the Mashiach. And it's very important, particularly now, that we keep davening, because they've been waiting for an excuse, and the excuse has been given. The act was necessary, and I think a laudable one, but the excuse is there nonetheless, and we definitely anticipate a hike in terrorist attacks. So please improve your increase your davening everywhere. Everywhere.
Yeah. Actually, they do say.
They do say in America, too. Mm. So we should increase our davening. Yeah. So, you know, you'll see hopefully over the next week if you come drive by our house, we started putting up monthly displays in our window. Those of you who saw our window in Purim, we had a big, the kids and I put up a big thing. So we're putting up for Nisan, B'Nisan Atidim Lehigael, the first part of that, B'Nisan Nigalu Abotenim, our forefathers were redeemed and freed in the month of Nisan. And the Gemara tells us, the Chazal tell us, U'B'Nisan Atidim Lehigael, and in the future, in Nisan, you'll also be redeemed. So let's, happy Rosh Chodesh.
Yes, yeah.
And, tomorrow. Tonight, yeah.